Good evening and welcome, friends, to Voices of the Sacred Feminine, whether you're across town or across the globe. As the snow deepens and many hearths are cold, I hope wherever you're listening from, you're safe, you're warm, and you're feeling embraced by the golden wings of our great mother. That cut opening tonight's show was a new one that was by a regular artist who's on the show often. Her name is Celia, and that particular new cut was called Wide Open. Later tonight, after my guest, please stay tuned in for my What's the Buzz segment talking about evolution and revolution and politicians scaring workers into voting against their economic interests. I want to know what you think also about the Beatles being political and cultural revolutionaries with the thought of where are today's counterparts to them. The chat room is open for comments throughout the show. And first up tonight, we have Glenda Lee Hoffman. She's the author of The Genesis Code, Your Key to Unlocking Hidden Genius. We're going to delve into magic and patterns of energy within the Hebrew letters. Hoffman believes the letters form a complex code of information about the fundamental properties of energy at the heart of all life in the universe. She also realized this info represented a revelation that pertains to the human brain that was historically understood and experienced by Abraham, Moses, Jesus, and others. We'll talk about Kabbalah as a hidden code within the text of Genesis, who Adam and Eve really were, and why she believes the Garden of Eden was a story about the brain and what that all means to us today. In the second half of the show, we see how we can use our hearts to save the world with Eileen Workman, author of Sacred Economics, The Currency of Life, discussing her spiritual awakening that led her to quit her job as a financial manager when she saw her job did not serve life. She examined the biggest problems facing the global economy and knows how we might change our economic system. And she'll give us some ideas about what individuals can do to protect themselves. So, as I said, the chat room is open. Please post your questions as they come up. We will try to get to them. So welcome, Glenda Lee. Let me start out by sharing with listeners your bio, and then we'll jump into some questions for you. As a young child in a turbulent home, Glenda Lee Hoffman had a series of mystical experiences that fueled her desire to understand, to pursue truth in a way that others did not, to see things that others never perceived, and look at things with a discerning and inquiring mind that yearned to touch a cosmic awareness that brought peace, serenity, and wholeness. It was in a contemplative community called the Christ Circle in Boulder Creek, California, that Glenda Lee first encountered the Kabbalah, an ancient teaching of coded interpretations embedded in the original text of Genesis, the Song of Songs, often referred to as the Song of Solomon, and the Sefer Yetzirah. In 1973, Hoffman began her studies of the Cipher of Genesis, the original code of Kabbalah as applied to the scriptures by French author Carlos Sorez. By reading Sorez's book dozens of times, Hoffman began to develop her own technique, seeing patterns unfold that were seeming clues to a greater knowledge. She focused on specific phrases that describe the attributes of the Hebrew letters, not as linguistic components, but as patterns of energy. This method allowed her brain to accumulate a vast library of information about the patterns of energy, which Sorez attributes to the Hebrew letters when viewed as elements of the code of Kabbalah. Soon it became clear to Hoffman that the letters formed a complex code of information about the fundamental properties of energy at the heart of all life in the universe. She also realized this information represented a revelation that pertains to the human brain that was historically understood and experienced by Abraham, Moses, Jesus, and others. And today we'll talk about what she discovered and has written about in her groundbreaking new book, The Genesis Code, Your Key to Unlocking Hidden Genius. So, Glenda Lee, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Karen. Thanks for inviting me.
Oh, you're welcome. You know, I was interested in what you had to say because I took Kabbalah classes for a while here in Los Angeles at the famous Kabbalah Center run by the Bergs. And we were taught that the Hebrew letters were a kind of, they called it technology, interestingly. And they believed, I'm sure you're going to go beyond this, but I found it interesting. They sort of treated the Hebrew letters like a talisman almost. They believed that the letters, you know, the combination of the three letters that were like the 72 names of God and the books like the Zohar, they could help keep you safe by just having them with you in your purse, in your car. You know, I guess maybe it's not too different than people with Jesus on the dashboard. So, you know, I I'm not really mocking it. You know, I mean, as a student there, one of the things we actually had to do as a project was to take these little Zohars. I think they called them Pinkas or something. I forget now. It's been a while. But actually hand them out around town to the police station, the fire station, places like that. And can you imagine that going into somebody at the front desk saying, "Here, this is for your safety. Keep this." It was an interesting experiment on all different levels. But anyway,
sure it was.
When they look at you like you're crazy, and then as soon as your back's out the door, you wonder if they tossed it in the trash or burned it because they thought it was the devil's work or something. But I wonder what your thoughts are about that. Does that figure into, you know, your whole paradigm?
No.
Okay.
No.
Fair enough.
Simple answer, no.
Okay.
The Kabbalah, and you'll notice that the Kabbalah school there is spelled with a K, right? K-A-B-A-L-L-A-H.
Yeah, is there a difference? I know it's spelled all different ways. Okay.
There's a reason for all of that.
Oh, well, start right there, please.
The Kabbalah I studied is spelled Q-A-B-A-L-A-H, and really, that is a linguistic rendition of an acronym that is composed of only four letters, Q, L, B, and H. The A's are just stuck in there so that you can pronounce it as a word.
Mm-hmm.
And this is the heart of the Kabbalah that I studied, because every word in the two stories of Genesis that I've spent 40 years studying, the 6 days of creation and the Garden of Eden, every word that we perceive as a word, because that's how we've been taught to look at the text, is actually an acronym that is constructed the same way that I just explained about the word Kabbalah.
So it's like they don't really have vowels, is what you're saying?
Not only do they not have vowels, they don't have consonants, because the letters that are used not as components of a language, but as components of an equation that are combined patterns of energy. I know it's very difficult for people to kind of grasp what I'm talking about, so I use the analogy that think of the way that letters are used in math. For instance, M equals mass and E equals energy. So
mm-hmm.
When letters are used in the context of math, they do not have a linguistic component, and everybody knows that.
Right.
We're so conditioned to think of this portion of Genesis as a linguistic text that it's very difficult for us to imagine it could be any other way. But I assure you, if you look at it from the original Hebrew, all you will see is capital letters that can be pronounced if you add vowels to it. But the point is not to perceive it as words, but to perceive it as an acronym, like, say, UCLA. You know, we're all, we know what UCLA means. It's not a word. It's an acronym, and it cannot be pronounced like a word. You have to pronounce each letter. Some acronyms can be pronounced like words, like MAD, Mothers Against Drunk Driving. But when I learned how to study the Kabbalah this way, by looking at the text of Genesis as a series of letters that form an equation, and the equation recreates a pattern of energy that is a part of life's structure everywhere. Again, this is all very difficult, but see, it has no relation at all to something, a talisman that keeps you safe. The entire text of this portion of Genesis is meant as a revelation, and every single time I was able to decode one of those equations, I did experience a revelation in my mind. In other words, my mind simply was lifted out of normal three-dimensional sensorial experience, and I found myself on a dimension of pure energy, and my perspective was non-time, non-space, and at the same time, it was very specific, it was a very specific insight into the structures and energies that create life, that created all of us, and that reveal to us the hidden dimensions of life that move throughout our body and into our mind, and eventually, if we stick with it long enough, reveal to us our own purpose in being human.
Okay, so I think I'm you know getting at least 50% of it. So forgive me if my question sounds kindergarten level or something, but so what you're saying is the book of Genesis that we're familiar with in the Bible, somebody went back and plugged in all the vowels. It didn't originally look like that. It looked like how you've described, with just the Hebrew letters without the vowels, because it wasn't really intended to speak a language to us. It was sort of speaking an energy of the universe to us.
Yeah, you got it. Very good, because these two stories in Genesis, they're the most famous stories in the Western world. Let's just say that. Even people who are atheists know about these two stories. Mm-hmm. They're just that. They're that embedded in our cultural history and our cultural knowledge. But just think now, the Hebrew alphabet does not have upper and lowercase letters. It only has one set of letters.
Right.
And so when we write acronyms, we use uppercase. And that's one of the ways that we distinguish between words and acronyms, is because acronyms are always written with all uppercase letters.
Right.
So, for instance, the first six letters of Genesis, Beit Resh Aleph Shin Yod Tav, those six letters have been translated as in the beginning. But when it took me 4 months to decode those six letters. I spent, and that, this was in the beginning of my studies. I had studied 5 months before that, so my total study was 9 months without getting anywhere. I didn't understand a thing, and it was the most frustrating, annoying experience of my life, but I had an invisible Annie Sullivan, like Helen Keller, who wouldn't let me leave and just kept scribbling these letters in my brain, and finally my brain was able to process the pattern, and what was revealed in those first six letters was an immense revelation that knocked my world completely off of where it had been.
Okay, so you're not going to dangle that carrot and not tell us what it was, right?
Well, I can try to explain it, but what I experienced can never be put into words, ever.
Okay.
It's impossible.
Give it a try.
but what it does describe and what I experienced when the revelation came to me, which I happened to be driving down the road, and I had to pull over because the experience was so powerful. I just sat there for probably a half an hour of just waves and waves of this energy washed through my mind, and I was like at the center of the universe at the very beginning, and I saw the spark that set it all off. And the spark looked like what we would describe as a seed. Mm-hmm. And in fact, Carlos Suarez describes it as the seed of life, the original seed of life.
So you saw in the beginning.
I saw in the beginning, but in the beginning was a seed. And the seed exploded and germinated, and it produced all the energy, like the Big Bang, that later became stars and galaxies and universes, and then on Earth, and this is the story told in Genesis 1, the Earth was void and then covered with water, and then the land appeared, and then the animals and plants, animals, and then us. So, but in those six letters was the whole story, and then it's like a equation. The first equation is like E equals MC squared, you know, Einstein's famous equation.
Mm-hmm.
But then, you know, that, a scientist who's decoding that will take 50 pages to write out all the equations that come out of that one.
Right.
So the book of Genesis is exactly the same. Those first six symbols include everything that follows. And then what follows that are all those details that are included in that those first six symbols, but not in the details that come later.
Okay. Well, and let's hold that thought, because I want to go back to the Kabbalah Center. And and again, it may, you know, I'm just trying to, for context, you know, have a point of reference with you. And I'm thinking about the 72 words of God, it was a chart that we had that, and there would be three Hebrew letters that didn't necessarily create a word, but they represented an energy that, I guess you could say, not just represented, they represent, like, for instance, three letters represented healing, three letters represented abundance, and there were 72 different ones of this, you know. And I almost wonder if, to a certain extent, it was the same thing, because I remember when they were teaching us to scan the Zohar, you know, they were really big on you don't really need to know what your reading, if you chose to read it in Hebrew, because it was affecting the unconscious mind. And honestly, I mean, we were at the very, very beginning of any of these classes, and I think they were trying to give us probably a very complex concept on probably pre-kindergarten level, so we could understand it on some sort of level. So I guess I just wonder about the 72 words of God. Is that something that you're familiar with? Sort of like what you're talking about? No. Okay.
No, first of all, the first precept of the Kabbalah that I studied is that there is no God in our normal way of thinking of it.
It's emanation theology. It's the light.
Right. Okay. So all there is life. That's mm-hmm. all there is. That's all there will ever be. And life includes everything. There's no duality at all. Life is all-inclusive, and it manifests in patterns of wholeness. And, of course, the best example of wholeness is a seed. Because the properties of life always include the properties of fertility. In other words, the first principle, let's say, first principle of the Kabbalah and of life is that life grows and life produces, how do I put this into words?
Well, it's the potential
life,
for all life.
Well, yeah, but there's an actual, one of the, this is interesting, the way Carlos Suarez describes it in the book that I studied is that the Kabbalah and life are perceived as a game, and that the game of life is, the goal of the game of life is to produce as much potential as possible. And the words that Carlos Suarez uses to describe that state is all possible possibilities.
Okay.
So, and see, that moves you right out of an intellectual realm, because the intellect cannot conceive of all possible possibilities. And
right.
yet, every seed is capable of producing that, because let's just say, for instance, an apple has, what, 8, 10 seeds in it. Each
mm-hmm.
one of those seeds can produce an apple tree, and that apple tree can produce, let's say, 300 apples, and inside each one of those 300 apples are these 8 to 10 seeds, and every single one of those seeds can produce another tree with the same amount of apples and seeds ad infinitum.
Right.
So right there is all possible possibilities. And this quality, or actually, Carlos Suarez defines it as an achievement of the game, because the game is played by two opposing forces that learn to work together, which are represented in those first six letters and in the rest of the story in Genesis by a seed, because it has the husk and the germ. And these two work together to create the energy cycles that eventually succeed in producing this highest level of fertility possible, all possible possibilities, and that the letter or symbol that represents that state is the number 7. And the name of that letter is Zain. And it's interesting to me that our number 7 still retains the very essence of the name of that symbol, Zain, 7 Zain. They're very
mm-hmm.
similar. Then the letter right after that is hate, and the number that follows 7 in our numerology is 8. And one of the things I've learned is that there are several names of these letters, and each letter has a number, and they've maintained the essence of their names in our modern alphabet and numerology.
Interesting. Okay,
that part is
so
interesting, yeah.
So now,
anyway, everything that takes place on the seventh day, which is the Garden of Eden story,
mm-hmm.
it all pertains to that number 7. And what I discovered is that the whole Garden of Eden takes place within the human mind. And, interestingly, scientists now realize that the human brain has achieved this same quality, all possible possibilities, because the number of connections between neurons in the brain is exactly that, all possible possibilities, because they have the ability to change connections forever.
Okay, so you've just said a lot, and
yeah.
forgive me, but you're going to have to spoon feed us and tell
right.
us how this is, you know, now give us the kindergarten version, you know, why is this
right.
relevant, and what can we do with the information, and how was the Garden of Eden about the brain?
So, what again, those first six letters, the first six symbols that describe the seed of life, was composed, like any seed, of germing elements and husking elements. And the germing elements are always expansive, disruptive, and fertile. And the husking elements are always structural and static and protective. But the germing elements always burst through the husk. That's the nature of growth. By reading all these letters and symbols through the definitions that Carlos Suarez was able to define, I learned to, my brain, all on its own, even unbeknownst to me, had created a lens through which then I began to see everything in the world in terms of husks and germs working together.
Can you give us an example?
So the germ is always inner. The germ is always an inner element, and it's always growing, and it's always disruptive to the static elements. And the husk is always an outer element and a protective element and a static element because it never changes. So once I had this lens occurred to me and I learned how to see everything, well, for instance, the earth itself. The earth itself has this core of molten iron or whatever it's composed of. And from that molten core, it created these volcanoes that spewed ash and minerals that created all the landmass on our planet. Exactly the way a seed would burst and create a plant that has a fruit.
Mm-hmm.
The land on our planet is the fruit of the this molten core of energy that's still, by the way, still blooming, you know, mm-hmm. on active volcanoes all over the world right now. It's
okay.
Still creating land. And then the husk of our planet is its atmosphere. This husk protects the planet from the cosmic rays that would destroy all life on this planet if we didn't have this protective atmosphere that must remain in this static, balanced state in order to protect us. So there's one example, just a real simple example. The brain itself. The skull plays the role of the husk, and the brain itself plays the role of the germ because the human brain happens to be capable of growing forever. Like a growing plant. It can continually grow new neurons, and in fact, every time we learn something new or learn to see life in a new way or ourselves or each other, we've grown new neurons or connected old patterns of neurons in a new way. So the brain is this very active, and in fact, So let me get back to Genesis. So the story of the 6 days of creation is the outer story. It's a cosmology, and it happens to tell the same story that scientists tell through evolution. The Big Bang, let there be light, and then the earth, and then it divided into the firmament and the planet that was void, and then it was covered with water, then, like I said, land, plants, animals, and us. That's the same pattern that scientists tell us about evolution. Then, on the seventh day, it starts another story, the Garden of Eden. And this story is very unlike the 6 days of creation. First of all, there's all this mythological imagery. This mythological imagery, you know, the man is created from dust, the woman is created from his rib, she talks to a snake, they eat a fruit that opens their eyes. This mythological imagery was supposed to be a clue to the reader to say, hey, there's something different about this story. The other clue is that everything that takes place in the garden takes place on the seventh day. The days are never again mentioned in this story. So these two clues are to tell the reader you need to change your concept and the context within which you look at this story. Well, by this time, I had my little lens of the seed had been built, and all of a sudden I realized, oh my gosh, this is the inner story of the cosmology that was told in Genesis 1. So if this is the inner story, then this must be a manual, let's say, for how to look at the human psyche or consciousness or awareness.
So Genesis was the story of the earth, the external, and the Garden of Eden is the story, is our internal story.
Is our internal story, exactly. That's exactly it. And, for instance, the trees of knowledge. Well, the only place you're going to find trees of knowledge are in the brain, and it just so happens that neurons resemble trees. They have a trunk
branches
that's called an axon, and then branches branch off one way, then you can call them branches, and then they also branch off from the bottom, and you could call them roots. But in as neurons, they act the same, and at the very tip of each one of those branches is something called a dendrite, and the word dendrite comes from a Greek word that means tree. And it's at our dendritic connections, which are called synapses, that create the neural pathways in the brain, and all information or knowledge is processed on these through these neural networks, which Genesis refers to as the trees of knowledge, specifically the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. Not only that, but modern scientists often use the metaphor of a neural jungle to describe the brain, because the way that the neurons entangle resembles a jungle. Well, jungle and garden have very similar meanings.
Right.
They're both referring to this unfettered growth that we see in nature.
And again, you're back to the endless possibilities idea.
Exactly. And so once I learned to see that the Garden of Eden story was about the brain and human awareness, and everything changed for me. And then the story began to make sense.
So then make it make sense for us. How did knowing that, understanding that, make any difference to your life? I mean, what did it suddenly make you understand?
Well, first of all, it made me understand that it was not about the past.
Or about a religion necessarily.
Yeah, it's not about religion at all. It's about human awareness, and it's actually a manual that teaches how to maximize our awareness so that we can become, so that all the hidden potential in our brain becomes available to us so that we can use it to solve our problems and be happy, creative, productive individuals.
Right.
And create that kind of culture.
So it's really about elevating our consciousness.
Exactly what it's about.
Yeah, because I remember just having a conversation with somebody recently, those words that say, in the beginning there was the Word. Well, actually, if you go back to the original, it wasn't in the beginning there was the Word. It was in the beginning there was consciousness. So it's almost as if, it's becoming clearer to me that there's so many different layers and levels of all of our different spiritualities or religions, and some people at the very lowest level maybe take everything very literally. And, the more you read and the more you compare this and that and, all of the different spiritualities and even science, you start to see that there's all of these different layers, and what it feels like to me is it's really all about our level of consciousness. The rest of it is really just extraneous details, in a sense. It's just metaphors and stories and for our more simple monkey brain to make some sense of things.
Specifically in the story in Genesis. Now, before I came in contact with the Kabbalah, which I never in my life was headed towards, I'd never even heard of it before a friend just gave me the book. When I was 5, I heard a voice that said, things are not what they appear to be. And when I was 11, I had a mystical encounter with Jesus. And the essence of that encounter was I recognized that all of Jesus' power emerged from his clarity or his enlightenment. That's another word for it. I like to use clarity because, to me, clarity is attainable for anyone. Whereas enlightenment has become this kind of thing that only those who study the longest or meditate the longest can become enlightened.
And maybe you never do.
Well, the story in Genesis is a story about a woman who eats a fruit that opens their eyes.
Right.
So this, again, for me, it was a trajectory that began when I was 5 with that message, and then things are not what they appear to be, and then asking Jesus to teach me to see, and then learning in the Kabbalah that the way to understand myself and look at my brain is by developing my perceptive abilities. And what you were just saying is that the huge lesson in Genesis for all of us is that if we don't learn how to train our brain to process information clearly and distinctly without biases or beliefs, without attitudes or values or all of the extraneous psychological stuff that we put on it, if we don't develop that skill, we will continue to create the toxic, messy cultures that we have created for the past 10,000 years. All of these cultures are created out of our unclarity, but we can become clear, and Genesis is a manual that actually teaches us how to do that.
Very interesting. In that sense, it could end up being, you know, maybe one of the most powerful books on the planet. However, considering its origins, I would imagine that in itself would be a stumbling block, you know?
Well, I'm going to attempt to do this anyway because I've learned it, and I want other people to know to free them from the limitations that many religions have imposed upon us. The story is about us. It's about us realizing the full potential of our brain and our awareness to solve our problems and become the vital, creative creatures that we are capable of being. And that unless we attain that state of consciousness, we won't be happy. So it behooves us to let that be our pathway. At any rate, the way that it teaches us in Genesis is through the exact verses that are in the story, and if we follow those, if we actually read those over and over and understand them clearly, we will understand what Adam and Eve understand after they eat the fruit. And first of all, to go back to the name of your show, which is
Sacred Feminine.
Forces of the Sacred Feminine.
Voices.
Okay, Eve is the savior in this story. And the reason she's a savior is because verses 7 and 8, I think, in chapter 3, and everybody has mistaken this, but the commandment to Adam was that he should eat from all the trees in the garden. That's the commandment. The next verse doesn't have a commandment. It has a warning. It says, but if you eat from the tree, the fruit of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, you will surely die. Now, there's no commandment there. That's just a warning. But see how it's been interpreted to be a commandment, and yet it's not. Mm-hmm. The commandment occurs in the verse before that, to eat all the trees. Then up to that point, this warning, don't eat that fruit or you'll die, who's in the garden? There's only one person in the garden up to that point, and that's Adam. Eve has not even been created yet. So Adam receives this commandment and warning while he's alone. The very next verse after that warning says, oh, but it's not good for Adam to be alone. He needs a helpmate. So then there's this big, you know, process, and Adam is put to sleep, and his rib is taken, and there Eve is created. And, of course, people don't understand what that is until you get down to the letter level and you realize this is about the brain, and I'm not going to go into that right now. But Further on in the story then, Eve gets the message from the serpent, well, if you eat this fruit, you're not going to die. What will happen is that you'll be wise. And she says to herself, well, I want to be wise. So she eats the fruit. Then she gives it to Adam. He eats it. And what happens to them? They don't die. That's what she does. So she has seen something in this fruit that he doesn't see, that he would not have seen if he were by himself. But she sees it. She says, don't believe me. Try it for yourself. So he eats it. The very next verse, their eyes are opened. Now, if you understand how this story has gone, you see that this is a miracle. He was warned, if you eat the fruit of this tree, you will surely die. Those are the exact words. You will surely die. But then when he does eat it, after she's eaten it first, they don't die. A miracle occurs. Their eyes are opened. But this portion of the story has not been interpreted clearly for 2,500 years. Instead, she is perceived as a sinner for disobeying a commandment that was never given, not even to her, because she didn't even exist in the story at the time the warning was given. And so then the whole story is completely distorted. Yeah. For 2,500 years, we've been thinking that this is a story about the past, when Adam and Eve actually represents parts of the brain.
Oh, okay. All right, forgive me if I've lost the thread, but you're saying Adam and Eve represent parts of the brain. I'm not connecting the dots.
Okay, so to make it really simple,
yeah.
Adam and Eve represent two types of intelligence in the brain, opposing types of intelligence, because everything in this story always relates back to the two opposing energies that always work together, the germ and the husk.
Ah, okay.
So Adam and Eve represent
the germ and the husk.
They're the germ and the husk in the brain.
Okay.
And to state them in the simplest way possible so that anybody can understand them, they are two types of intelligence. One is a germ intelligence. One is a husking intelligence. And their names are intellect and intuition. So guess who's who.
Well, yeah. I mean, you have the left and the right side of the brain, the masculine and the feminine, you know, everything that feminist theology teaches, you know. And that whole thing about, you know, Eve, you know, reaching for the apple, you know, reaching for the tree of knowledge, you know, I mean.
Okay, let me clarify it for you. Right. Let me clarify it for you. So Adam is the intellect. And he is told he needs a helpmate. And Eve is created. Now, she's intuition. And this is the helpmate he needs. And the reason he needs this helpmate, so that we can think better, mm-hmm. is because intuition has the ability to go into the unknown and extract potential from the unknown and serve and help the intellect understand it. The intellect cannot go into the unknown. The intellect can only process information that's already known.
Yeah. Yeah, so he needs her to broaden his horizons.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So he's been told, don't eat the fruit of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, or you will surely die, ... because you're alone. In your intellectual, stagnant way of thinking, you can't get out of your own self. You need a helpmate. Here she is. I'm going to create you from one of your own ribs. Well, we've been taught to think of the left hemisphere and the right hemisphere, but in this particular situation, we're talking about the neocortex and the frontal lobe, because the frontal lobe emerged out of the neocortex the same way the rib came out of Adam and was made into Eve. In other words, the tissue that forms the frontal lobe, which was the final portion of the brain to evolve, and the only portion of the brain that's uniquely human, sits right behind the forehead.
Okay, so, I mean, this is all making more sense. You know, Adam and
right.
Eve, I mean, you know, nobody ever, I doubt that any of my listeners ever took Adam and Eve literally anyway, but once we know that, then how do we apply it? I mean, how does it become useful to us?
So, in the story, Eve is, the serpent talks to Eve and says, if you want to be wise, then eat that fruit. So she goes, okay, she eats the fruit. Now the fruit had been termed the knowledge of good and evil, but what Eve sees is a completely different context. What she sees is the context of life, because she's intuition. She can go into the unknown, and in the unknown she can see that life is always created through whole systems. There is no duality ever in life. So she sees that, oh, wait a minute, this is a fruit that emerged from the tree, that was grown by the seed, that is the essence of the whole system. This is not the knowledge of good and evil. This is the knowledge of life. And so she gives it to Adam, and he eats it, and oh, now they see that this is the knowledge of life. So, of course, their eyes are opened, which means their consciousness has now expanded. And we have to do the same thing. We have to eat all the fruit of knowledge, especially the knowledge of duality, and we have to transform it inside of our own minds so that we realize there is no such thing as duality. Duality is an illusion, and it's perpetuated by all kinds of social institutions, including education, economics, and religion. But
okay.
The truth is, duality doesn't exist. We create it out of our own illusion, and so then it does exist, but it only exists in culture, not in life.
And that's
the big difference.
Right, right. So it's our culture that has taught us to see everything as good and bad, black or white, male, female,
right.
blah, 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 that gets us into trouble. And it's that, so I see where you're going with that. Interesting way to get there. But,
well, again, I didn't start out to go there. I was brought there by this strange teaching that frustrated me to no end until it opened my brain. And, I mean, it literally opened it for me. I mean, it was like somebody took a chisel and a hammer and busted my brain open, and then life could flow in.
Right, right, right.
You know, because it had to bust through my own husking energies that were... Go ahead.
Well, what I was about to tell you is it's 10 to 7.
This always happens.
It's taken us a really long time to get this. This is a complicated concept.
It is.
So we're going to have to sort of wrap up. I mean, I know we were sort of getting to a conclusion toward the end there, but if you could take maybe 5 minutes, if you need it, and say, you know, what is it besides what you just said, you know, about, you know, rejecting duality? Is there more that we need to know about this?
There's so much more, but. What I would like to say is that for all your listeners, I have a free ebook that goes along with my book, The Genesis Code, Your Key to Unlocking Hidden Potential. You go to my website, www.thegenesiscode.com, and you can put your email in this little window, and I will send you a free ebook titled 7 Techniques to Cultivate Your Genius. And the exercises in the ebook were some that I devised, some that I learned from other teachings, but they are all designed to help us move beyond our cultural conditioning into discovering our own genius and creativity.
Well,
and
yeah.
The main message is we all do this the same way. We all gain consciousness by expanding our horizons and our perspective beyond the limitations that culture has conditioned into us.
And I didn't hear if you mentioned, because I was reading something someone wrote in the chat room. Did you say what your website was, Glendalee?
Yes, www.thegenesiscode.com.
Thegenesiscode.com. Interesting. Well, Glendalee, besides the ebook, which is very generous, thank you for offering that to listeners. Is there something you'd like to say to sort of, wrap it up a little bit?
Just that the story of Genesis is not about God or the past. The story of Genesis is about us. It's about our relationship with our brain and with our own consciousness. And if we learn to create that relationship through the patterns of life, which I explain in my book, then we will be on our way to expanding our awareness and overcoming our limitations and solving our problems and discovering that happiness is attainable and it's natural. It's our natural state of life. And when we attain that state, I say to people, I get to live in heaven, because that's what it feels like. How that happens is that as you learn to decondition your brain and follow the patterns of life, you become healthier.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, the word health comes from a German word that means whole. So the more we get rid of duality in our thinking and in our attitudes and values, and the more we recognize that life is always whole systems and that everything is included, and the more we learn how to love ourselves completely and unconditionally, the happier and less stressful our life becomes.
So thank you for wrapping that up. But I have a question going back to the original writers. Do you think they knew what you are talking about, but they went ahead and put the vowels in to sort of simplify things for the less educated, so to speak? Does this exist in other teachings other than Hebrew?
First of all, those weren't the original writers. The original writers still had everything in code. Those were the original writers.
Well, who
Abraham.
Were they, though? Oh.
Pardon?
But they were Hebrew.
The letters of the Hebrew alphabet, at that time, there was no alphabet. There were just these symbols, and they were not part of a linguistic system at all. They were like, think of runes.
Mm-hmm.
Runes are just symbols that
right.
do not apply to a language. Well, that's what these symbols were before they became the elements of the Hebrew alphabet. It was only after the text was written in code that these became the letters of the Hebrew alphabet. Now, interestingly,
okay.
I'm going to take a little side bar here, the alphabet itself has the same qualities as a seed. In other words, from the alphabet, any word that we can think of can be produced. So the alphabet has attained the number 7, all possible possibilities.
And going back to the question I had, is this the concepts that are at the heart of this? Do you find it in other sources other than what we're calling the Hebrew letters?
The concepts of wholeness are definitely contained within most, or I would say all spiritual teachings, and even at the essence of all religions. So that part of it, yes, is included. The details of the Kabbalah, of the patterns of energy, are actually being discovered as we speak by science. And I hope to form a group in the next year that actually wants to learn how to decode this information and apply it scientifically so that we can spread the word more efficiently than I can by myself.
And what branch of science is discovering more about this?
Well, quantum science, for one thing. Quantum science, the essence of quantum science is that everything is connected.
Mm-hmm.
Everything, and that time and space are not fixed.
Yeah.
They are, so that part of it there. Now, neurology is also beginning to discover many of these properties.
I'm curious.
Go ahead.
Does this go into, like, different dimensions? I mean, like, I know science is starting to talk about, you know, maybe there are as many as 10 different dimensions and...
For people that relate to dimensions, that might be useful information. I don't happen to relate to different dimensions, so it's not useful information to me. I have a very practical consciousness and perspective. So to me, talking about dimensions isn't very helpful, but talking about the brain and about how neurons work and about how intuition can go into the unknown and extract information for the intellect to process, that I can relate to. Other people will call that different dimensions, but I don't know how to relate to that, so I don't talk that way.
I understand. Okay. Well, Glenda Lee, it has been interesting, and I'm sorry we have to, you know, cut our interview short, but again, thank you, you know, for the generosity of the ebook option, too, so that, you know, people can get their hands on some of those exercises and maybe try some of this out and get a little more familiar with it. Interesting stuff here. You know, I always love listening to my guests because I learn something new every week, and I don't say that lightly. I really do. So thank you so very much for the work you're doing out there in the world, and keep in touch. Let me know how this is going. Let me know if you form the group, and, you know, if there's anything else you want to share, get back in touch, and, you know, maybe we'll have you on again.
Okay, wonderful. Karen, you've been a fabulous host. I just want to mention one thing. My book
Sure.
is also available on Amazon, and it's also available in Kindle. So you can get
Okay.
it on my website, on Amazon, and on Kindle. And again, Karen, thank you so much for inviting me. You've been a wonderful host.
Well, thank you so much. And listeners, one more time for her title, The Genesis Code, Your Key to Unlocking Hidden Genius by Glenda Lee Hoffman. Thank you, Glenda Lee.
Yes, good evening.
All right, good night.
Most people's psychic experiences are dreaming, and it's thought that it's the pineal gland making this chemical that does it. Now, this was the core finding that the pineal gland makes a hallucinogen. We all hallucinate, we all go into a state of consciousness that for me is the collective unconscious. This psychic state is the collective unconscious, which is that consciousness of the planet, what's called the chthonic mind, the mind of the earth, because all people, all races, all tribes from the past and right around the world have myths and legends which use symbols and archetypes which are identical. Every human being experiences this state of consciousness, which is the dream mind, that symbolic, archetypal, exemplified by fairy tales or the creation myths and legends of all the different peoples. The symbols of them are the same, and to me that is the consciousness of the earth speaking to us.
Well, that was Serena Roney Dougal, PhD, speaking in Joe Carson's film, Dancing with Gaia. Dancing with Gaia is a documentary that explores the connection between earth energy, sacred sexuality, and the goddess as Gaia. It features 15 visionaries who give us tools to feel the life of the planet within ourselves, and the DVD comes with a 45-page mini-book, and it costs only $20. You can get your own copy at dancingwithgaia.com. So it's about that time. We are crossing the threshold into the second half of the show. And as I wait for our next guest, Eileen Workman, to come on with me to talk about sacred economics, I want to take a minute to tell you about my new book, if you haven't heard about it. It's Goddess Calling, Inspirational Messages and Meditations of Sacred Feminine Liberation Theology. It's available to pre-order, so I hope you'll go over to Amazon or your local bookseller and put your order in. If you order it now from Amazon, you'll get a 20% early bird discount, making it less than $20 with shipping. It's got great reviews from Jean Houston, Barbara Walker, Z Budapest, Joan Norton, Isadora Forrest, and many others. And just so you know, pre-orders are very important for new books. And I hope you can help by going there and placing your order now. So thank you, my dear listeners. Some of you have emailed me and told me that you have already pre-purchased the book, and I really thank you from the bottom of my heart. See, you really are the gas in my tank in so many ways. And while we're on the subject, if you're in Southern California, I mentioned my upcoming party and ritual that we're going to be doing to launch my new book. I'm doing this great presentation on the Faces of Goddess in Washington, D.C. The presentation is called Founding Mothers, Goddess in Washington, D.C., A New Pilgrimage Site, and Liberation Theology of the Sacred Feminine. It's for men and women. It's going to be April 19th from 7 to 10 p.m., so save the date. It's going to be at the Goddess Temple of Orange County, and it's from 7 to 10, and it's free. And there's new news. We've named the incredible talent that's going to contribute to making the night a lot of fun. Internationally renowned drum and rhythm facilitator Rowan Storm will be doing interactive rhythm balance. There will be songs and chants by the Circle Singers and Sacred Belly Dance by Maria. So truly, truly, I think the party's going to be a feast for the senses for both your left and right brain. Weren't we just talking about that? Your divine feminine and sacred masculine self within, the cognitive and the intuitive, the intellectual and the intuitive, as Glenda Lee was talking about. And if you've ever wondered about the goddess sites in and around Washington, D.C. and the possible connection between the founding fathers and goddess, the visual presentation, I'll offer some tantalizing clues, and I think you'll leave with few doubts they ever intended the United States to be a Christian nation. And I think you'll start thinking about Washington, D.C. in a new way, too. Who would have ever thought it to be a pilgrimage site to Goddess? And I can't stop talking about this without saying that if you've yet to visit the internationally acclaimed Goddess Temple there in Irvine, California, the only one of its kind in the world, it's a perfect opportunity for a visit to see what's new and glorious at the temple, including the new centerpiece in the sanctuary, which is the larger-than-life-size statue of the Egyptian lion-headed goddess Sekhmet on her 4-foot-tall pyramid throne. I got to tell you, it is pretty impressive. So thank you for indulging me to get the word out, and I hope my dear listeners within driving distance of Southern California will make this important and amazing event. So I see Eileen is on the switchboard, so I'm going to get to her in 2 seconds here. But I want to remind you to stay with me after our guest for my What's the Buzz segment, when I chat with you about the bees buzzing round in my bonnet that speak to what's happening in the world, supporting or marginalizing women and the sacred feminine. So, Eileen, welcome to the show.
Hi, Karen. Thank you.
Well, let me start off by introducing you to listeners by way of your bio, and then we'll jump right in and talk about sacred economics, okay?
That's wonderful.
So this is Eileen Workman, dear listeners. She says, I spent 16 years as an investment advisor and portfolio manager for a well-known international investment company. At the peak of my career, I personally managed over $100 million and annually earned in the mid-six figures. In 2007, I quit my job cold turkey after what I call a spiritual awakening, what the medical profession considers a nervous breakdown. Because, you see, Eileen had reached a point in her life where not even the money and success she was earning could compensate for the fact that she saw what she was doing did not serve life, and in fact, it was life negating. She says, I then spent the next several years writing and launching Sacred Economics and have been actively involved in empowering others to shift their way of thinking about human relationships and social enterprise ever since. Well, brava for you, Eileen. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Well, and thank you for doing this. You know, it used to be greed was one of the seven deadly sins, but not anymore. And, you know, every time I turn on the news and, they talk about the income disparity and people out of work and the middle class dying and the 1% having more than, you know, the rest of the planet, it's sickening, you know, it's sickening. And you gave up an awful lot to walk your talk.
I did, and it's an interesting experience to suddenly realize that everything that, for me, everything I was raised to believe I was supposed to accomplish and the pinnacle of success, you know, I did everything I was supposed to do, and I got to that pinnacle, and suddenly I looked around and said, is this all there is? Is this what it's about? Why doesn't anyone talk about what we're here for, what it all means, how we're supposed to be in relationship with one another. So those questions really became the energizing force that moved me out of the experience of just doing more of the same and caused me to really ask some deep questions and figure out what it was that we're actually here to do.
Well, you know, Eileen, I've always had enough. I have to say I've never suffered like so many people in poverty suffer. But I've never had an overabundance either. So it's hard for me to imagine, what it must be like to have that much money, but still these people are driven, it seems, obsessively. And I just keep hearing this phrase in my head, when is enough enough? When is enough enough? And I guess I don't understand what motivates these people. And I know you want to talk about economics, but I wonder if you can answer that.
I can, because having lived through it and having worked with so many individuals who are so desperately unhappy, my sense of it is that when we don't have a really profound purpose that is greater than ourselves, that we're here to serve in the world, there's an emptiness inside of us. And when the purpose that we're serving, which is the cultural purpose that we've been encouraged to serve, which is self, how do I get what I need from the world, get, then we're in the modality of constantly needing to get. But because mm-hmm. there's that profound emptiness, that lack of satisfaction in what we're doing, you can never get enough to fill that hole.
Right.
Ironically, the moment that we switch our energy and begin giving, and we start giving out of love and out of compassion and out of the desire to see life flourish, we become abundant within ourselves, and that hole magically fills itself. It becomes a fountain. And so there's this reversal of energy from this desperate need to suck things into ourselves and surround ourselves with things to just recognizing how much we have to bring forth. And that's the real transformational shift. But those people that are still chasing haven't done that yet. They're still looking for enough to fill up.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I can speak to it on a much smaller scale, I think. You know, when I first was finished school and, you know, I lived in the South. So, you know, women were conditioned to, okay, you start a family. Well, I knew I didn't want children, but, you know, I got married, we got a house, did the two cars thing, and I felt empty. You know, it's like, okay, so is this all there is? You know? And so I started trying to fill the hole with hobbies and projects, and that wasn't really doing it either. And interestingly, I met my current husband, and he was my soulmate, the love of my life. And that, I think that love really filled that hole, you know, I'd say probably 75%. But then when I started being in service to the community, it really felt like the hole was filled 100%. So, you know, it's like I can see people with this incredible wealth and really not envy it, because so many people I know are so miserable, you know, because I think, you know, they think that their wealth is really the key, but I don't think it's sustaining. I don't think it fills them very long, you know. It's kind of like a quick fix that doesn't last. And, you know, maybe they keep needing more and more wealth and bigger and more toys, and you know, and they only get a, you know, maybe a short-term gratification from that, and they're on to the next domination or acquisition, or I don't know. I'm rambling here, but it makes sense.
No,
to
I think
me.
You're right on target. You're totally on track, and there's a deep and profound truth to what it is that you're referencing, which is that when we buy into cultural belief that our primary life is to go out and do things, and that success is measured by what we accomplish and how much we do and how much we get from that doing, that really is the masculine archetype at play, the go out and thrust and go do, and whatever you create and build is yours, and you sell it and you make all this. What's missing from that equation is the feminine archetype, the divine feminine element of the joy of nurture, what it makes us human, what makes a child to be doing the doing. So all this doing that we're doing now has no real purpose or intention to it other than to try to fill these endless cravings in the self for some sort of sense of satisfaction and purpose. And as a result, we're depleting our planet, we're destroying resources, we're completely decimating ecosystems and extinguishing all kinds of forms of life. We're at war with ourselves, we're at war with one another. And all of that pain and suffering has emerged because we're desperate for meaning in our lives. And that's the divine feminine archetype that is not honored in the current economic paradigm. We completely negate it. We discount it and we denigrate it as not having value. That's the government's business. So the things the government has chosen to do have really been to sort of step in and backfill that missing divine feminine paradigm. And because there's money in it, there's no value for it, it's considered something that we really resent having to pay for because we don't get immediate gratification for it.
Right.
So these are some of the real fundamental challenges we have as a species, is the rehabilitation of the divine feminine such that our economy is whole and we're not only capitalizing, monetizing, and valuing half of what we are, the doing half, and the being half gets completely annihilated.
Well, and you think about some of our religions, too. I mean, granted, you know, or maybe I'm just thinking about the loud ones, but, you know, you have, you know, Christianity that's been sort of co-opted by these, you know, Ayn Rand rugged individualists who curse the poor and think they're just lazy and aren't working hard enough and think their riches are blessings from God. And, you know, where it used to be about, you know, being in service to the community, serving the poor, helping the poor, you know, it's incredible how even religion, for not everybody, of course, but for so many, even religion, you know, the goodness of it has been warped into something that looks more like it's about acquiring wealth and greed as well, you know. So it's like even sort of the institutions that may have helped us achieve wholeness, you know, they don't really have spokespeople anymore, or at least not very loud ones that are telling. Well, the Pope just recently now, you know, has come out, you know, against greed and saying, you know, we have to do something about poverty and income disparity. But you know, it's so far it's just lip service. You know, I don't know that there's anything more he can do but use lip service. Until him, I mean, we went years and years and years, and I can't remember anybody talking about that out there in the public sphere. Instead, it was the Wall Street guy, whose name escapes me now, the Michael Douglas character. You know, greed is good.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
mm-hmm.
exploit anybody you can, just don't get caught, kind of a thing. You know, it's really sickening when you think about it. It's like a disease.
It is, and that, you know, to me, I like to take what I call an evolutionary viewpoint or perspective on human development, because it's kinder and gentler than simply taking a historic perspective. Because from an evolutionary perspective, we can look at our own history and say, you know, that early stage when we were hunter-gatherers and we had the goddesses and religions, we were children in the garden. I'm thinking what your last caller said as well, and there's parallels and correlations here. When we were children in that space, we were innocent. We didn't understand the separation between male and female or differences. We just played, and we trusted the world to give us everything we needed. We, you know, hunter-gatherers followed their food around, and they just lived very simply. When we became adolescents or teenagers, we moved into that more conscious, aware space where there was separation, and we felt separation from each other, male from female. We were changing. We were different. We didn't understand the differences. And suddenly the world, rather than being our sustenance, became suspect. It became our enemy, and we had to protect ourselves from it. So we separated ourselves from the world. And the agrarian cultures were born, where we had to start to collect things and save and protect ourselves from potentially drought-based futures. So all of these imaginative fears came into play. And that's been our historical movement for probably 7 to 10,000 years. It's been human consciousness in adolescence. And I suspect what we're experiencing now is the verge of us moving into young adulthood. And there's some really significant transitions that happen when we move from, as a person, as individuals, from adolescence to adulthood that should be mirrored on the species level. Some of those transitions involve us letting go of competition and moving into deeper cooperation. We lose our narcissism and our complete self-consciousness and become more in tune with the whole of the world. Our compassion evolves, our capacity to see the world as connected, our desire for intimacy arises, our willingness to delay gratification and to have long-term objectives comes to the forefront, whereas, you know, teens are much more aggressive and rash and about instant gratification. Teens are very insecure. They need a lot of validation, and they need external validation and conviction that they're okay, whereas adults drop into that sort of quiet confidence. I'm doing all right. I can handle this. I know mm-hmm. my own mind and my truth. So mm-hmm. as that moves into our species, and I see it happening person by person as consciousness is flowering across the planet, the systems that we built to manage us in our adolescence, our economies, our politics, our religions, our justice systems, all of those systems, which are power, dominator, punishment, and reward, externally manifest systems, will not suffice us to help us manage us in our adulthood, because they're too juvenile. They're holding mm-hmm. us back from bringing forward the best that we are. So every one of those systems is outmoded. And economics is probably the system that is the most painful right now, because it's running the show and it's what we're all doing. And unfortunately, it's destructive in its current form. We've moved through its capacity to serve us well and really help us and support us in adolescence. And now it's becoming terribly, terribly destructive to our capacity to graduate into adulthood. So it's time for a significant change.
Well, you know, to me it seems like it's become, you know, almost like a maniac child, you know, sort of like predator capitalism. You remember that old movie, The Bad Seed, where the little girl was, you know, killing everybody?
Yeah.
You know, that's you know, if I could personify the economy. But, let's sort of get into the meat of it. Did you want to, I mean, I know you said you had a spiritual awakening that just I mean, it had to be pretty profound that just shook you to the core. I mean, did you want to say what it was? Was it a particular moment or thing in particular that just knocked your socks off?
Well, it was an event. I mean, I went through approximately 5 to 7 years of soul searching, challenging myself, shamanic exploration, religious study, all kinds of, I studied theoretical physics. I wanted to understand the world in a different way than the surface way I had been taught to understand it. And I knew that the way I was living it wasn't satisfying. So as I was on that journey and I investigated all of these different corridors of inquiry, ultimately it brought me to an experience in my life where I suddenly had this realization that virtually everything I had ever been taught to believe about the world was wrong. And that I had inside my brain built this incredible structure of belief that had been handed to me by experts, parents, adults, teachers, very well-meaning people who said, this is what you're supposed to believe, and we know, and this is the truth. And so know this, spit it back out, regurgitate it unadulterated, and you'll be fine. Well, I was never invited to or empowered to question those things, but they didn't feel good. Those structures did not reflect the reality I was experiencing. So when I had this event, basically what it was like a nuclear bomb went off inside my head and blew up all those structures. And suddenly I went back down to absolute zero. I believed nothing. I took a moment and I said, everything I believe is false. Let me start fresh from this space, as if I know nothing, but I have the capacities of an adult to think. I'm no longer a child that has to believe everything that the adults tell me. I get to decide now what I put back. And so I went through a period of several days where all I did was be alive and experience the world in a completely fresh and childlike way, but with an adult sensibility. And I tested beliefs that I had held for years and wasn't sure if they were true, and discovered which were and which weren't. And gradually, during the course of that complete shattering and reconfiguration, I began to develop a spiritual worldview. I saw it all. I felt it all. I experienced the world as one living, unified field, eternal, completely eternal. The moment is eternal. All that happens in this eternal moment is this constant manifestation of creative change. The eternal life force that's moving and dancing in this world that's capable of infinite change. And that's what we perceive as the passage of time, is just these changes that are happening within the field itself. And we're in that. We are that. So the very consciousness that we are holding is eternal life manifesting in this temporary form as one of its creations, one of these temporary but infinitely potential creations. And to make that transition, to let go of being a separate thing that was on the world but not of it or in it, to being totally interconnected and interdependent with the whole of the whole, completely shifted my perspective. And I use the word sacred in the title of my book, Sacred Economics, very deliberately, because from that perspective, everything that I see, experience, relate to is sacred because it's all alive, it's all eternal, and it's all infinitely creative, and it's the one divine field, and I'm in it. So I cannot consciously, when I'm in that space, do any kind of deliberate harm to the field because I would be hurting myself.
Yeah.
Every person I meet, just a reflection, the reflection of myself, they're me in disguise. Hello. We're all God. So from that perspective, it's a different way of being.
Well, yeah, and imagine if, I don't know, you know, I dream this dream that, you know, one day somehow, you know, the people that write the checks will suddenly have some compassion for the people that cash the checks, and, you know, the people on Wall Street, you know, there'll be no more exploiters, you know. The oil companies won't want to keep raping the planet for profits and on and on and on. You know, we won't have GMOs and, you know. But of all of these things, I mean, what do you see as the biggest problem that faces the global economy today?
Well, I think the biggest problem is what we were talking about, that people are not awakened to the interconnectivity. And the joy of that is that the way that the system works is that if you ignore the truth, it knocks on you a little bit louder. So the more that we avoid embracing the truth of our interconnectivity and our interdependence, not dependence or codependence or independence, but interdependence, we are interlocking puzzle pieces in this entire moving system, this divine field. So every time we do something like fracking that doesn't honor what the system is, because we're destructing it in order to extract more than we need or more than we're entitled to, it'll create earthquakes, and it'll give us feedback that's negative feedback. Don't do this. And if we continue, we'll get louder and more pressing feedback. So the world itself is giving us feedback. The planet is giving us feedback. You can't keep behaving this way. And ultimately, the things that we depend on to hold struggle at bay, to keep fear at bay, money and power, will not work when we confront the universe. It doesn't care how much money we have. We can't go to it and say, well, gosh, we need more trees. Here's $1 billion. It'll last because that's not, it doesn't operate in our culture. So our culture has to be deeply connected to the cosmos. It can't be separate from it. And by separating our culture, we're risking self-extinction by refusing to honor the feedback that we're getting and thinking our money and power will protect us from the consequences of our own behavior.
Yeah, you know, I know this might be simplistic, but, you know, sometimes I sit down and I think, you know, do these people who are poisoning the water and poisoning the air, yeah, they can hide themselves behind their big walls, but eventually they're going to, you know, they have to breathe the same air and they have to drink the same water we do, you know. It's going to eventually catch up with them too, even though they sort of seem like they may be the last ones to suffer from the damage they've done, because their money does buffer them, you know, more than it does the poor person or the person living from paycheck to paycheck.
Yeah, and that's the hard thing to witness, but it is the truth, is that ultimately there is nowhere to hide. So even the people that think that they can hide behind these vast walls of billions of dollars and shield themselves from the consequences of planetary destruction still live on the same planet in the end that we do. And so the real question is how quickly such people wake up to the truth and recognize that they have an obligation to change the behavior and begin to move through this world in a sacred manner. And from my experience, the fact that I could change it in myself at my age with my level of success means that it can be done before the planet is completely decimated. So I have trust that the system, that life knows what it's doing and that it's giving us the signals that we need, and it will continue to knock on the interior consciousness of the people who need to hear it, and that those of us who have heard the call will continue to come together and form islands of coherence where we can begin to create new systems, better systems, more loving systems that render the old ones obsolete, so that as the old ones crumble and we hospice them out of existence, we can be midwifing in simultaneously these new systems and new ideas that are going to be trickle up. No more of this power top down. It's going to be trickle up from the masses creating new energies and saying, hey, this feels good. Why don't we try this?
Well,
so
I mean, let's face it. I mean, nature teaches us that, doesn't it? I mean, things don't grow from the top down. You know, things grow from the ground up.
Absolutely.
You know, but,
and we've been trying to do this top-down imposition of order as, you know, which, again, is the rashness and impatience of adolescence. I'm just going to make everybody do it my way.
Right,
and as we move into adulthood, we discover it takes a long time. But you have to be patient. You have to support a child in development.
So where do you think we're headed, you know, given the globalization of capitalism and multinational corporations and, you know, all the damage they're doing across the globe?
Oh, that's a really hard question for me to answer, because I don't like projecting fear or imagination into the future. I do know that that which is unsustainable cannot sustain itself. So I have every confidence that these systems are totally unsustainable, which means that something has to give. So there's a couple of outcomes that are possibilities in that process. You know, one outcome is that we have incredibly decimating wars and destruction, and humanity gets taken all the way back down to the bare bones of itself and has to start again, which isn't a very pretty scenario. Another scenario is that we gradually begin to recognize and come together and make these changes and transitions as a community, starting with the richest nations that have the capacity to deliver to the poorest nations and going that way. You know, there's all kinds of outcomes. It could happen literally overnight. I mean, literally, we could have a bolt from the blue and wake up and suddenly everybody realizes they love each other and we sing Kumbaya. I honestly don't know. You know,
I think that would take a bigger threat. You know, it's like we would have to see flying saucers on the horizon, I think, for everybody on the planet to feel like they were united in unity. But I'm kidding, but only partially.
Yeah, no, I agree with you. That's the beauty of surrendering to the unknown, is that there's literally no way to know what the cosmos will conspire to deliver to us to encourage us to make this transition. But
right.
I believe most teenagers survive. Some of them die, and there is a possibility that on this planet, this spark of life might not make it through its adolescent years. We might hit the accelerator, run into a brick wall, and kill ourselves. We have certainly the nuclear capacity to do that. But, you know, the odds are we're going to get through it. So the real question becomes not how we're going to get through it as a collective, but what can I do as an individual to support and nurture that transition as we make this transformation as a community? Because it has to be a communal shift. It cannot be just one person doing it all. We have to do it together. So how that, you know, then I look to myself and say, what can I do differently? How can I step outside the existing economic paradigm and bring into this world a different way of being?
And what did you come up with?
Well, I mean, I've made significant transformations in my own life experience. I would say that the primary thing I have chosen to do is to honor the notion of indirect gifting that I see as the life force in the blueprint of life itself. As I look to nature, I don't see anything that is doing direct exchange. A gives to B, B gives to A, and ends. I see A manifesting out of its own abundance into the world, and then B, C, D, and E all pick up on that and use bits and pieces of it, and then they manifest into the world what they have to offer, and then F, G, and H pick up on that. And eventually it comes back around to A. It gets what it needs from the system as the whole transformation and, you know, utilization of all the things that have been produced come back around to deliver what it needs.
So like a bartering system or something? I mean, I know I've heard Genevieve Bond talk about gift economy, but I don't fully understand how would the landlord get paid his rent, you know, unless you did his landscaping for him or something. You know, I mean, is that the kind of thing you're talking about?
No, because there's an assumption in that particular thought process that payment is necessary for services rendered. That that's what I mean by direct exchange. If I perform a service, then I expect immediately to receive compensation for it, and that compensation has to be of what I consider fair value to what I've rendered. But in reality, how do we compare a hammer to an apple? We're taking two completely diverse things and trying to set a price or a value on those things as if how they're used has no meaning. And in fact, what life tells us is how something is used is all that its meaning is about. It has no meaning until it's used. So for us to try to formulate these mechanical systems whereby we make sure that we get reimbursed immediately for whatever it is we do, that is what is creating lack in our society. If we trusted each other and said, I'm going to do what I'm capable of doing out of love of doing it, and I'm going to trust that when I need something, somebody who loves doing it will be there because I say I have need. And so it's a completely elevated and enlightened way of engaging with one another, not as separate individuals who need to reclaim from one another some value, but as part of a whole, the way cells and organs work in a body. We're an organism on this organic planet. So you wouldn't have your liver cell negotiating with your blood cell over whether or not it's going to remove the toxins in the blood cell and charge it some fee for that, and then have the blood cell say to the liver cell, well, I'm not going to feed you unless you pay me a certain amount, because your body would fall apart in about 17 seconds.
They
know they're working for a higher purpose, which is the survival of the body, and the survival of the body such that it can hold and support and nurture every single diverse and unique cell into becoming the best it can be.
I hear you, okay, but I'm trying to be pragmatic, and I'm thinking to myself, that would mean that people would live rent-free. They'd be able to go into the grocery store and get what they needed. The people who would normally have collected rent or collected money for these groceries or medical services or whatever it is, it's almost as if everybody would just be in service to one another, because maybe then the landlord doesn't need your rent because he can go to the grocery and get what he needs, and he can go to the medical doctor and get what he needs, so he doesn't have to collect anything from you. So everybody, whatever everybody has and whatever everybody does, they just do it for the community, and people just, they take what they need from everybody else, kind of.
Out of love. Love and service and the sheer enjoyment of experiencing yourself in your own capacity to deliver into the world something magnificent. For me, that was the real linchpin of this process, was recognizing, when I sat down and wrote my book, the joy that I felt watching this wisdom pour through my body, into my fingers, out through the keyboard, onto the page, and into this book, was like having a child. Any mother out there can tell you that when they give birth to a child, they don't feel like their husband should write them a check for them having done the work. There is this intrinsic joy of manifesting what you're capable of creating. And when we recognize and honor and appreciate that, nobody has to pay you to do what you do. It's who you are. And holding back seems ridiculous. Why are we all sitting here out of work? Nobody wants to do anything because no one's writing checks. And yet we live in a world where there's so much work to be done. We have to clean up all the pollution. We've got all these creative endeavors that we have to accomplish. We need to beautify the world. We need to figure out how to do things in more sustainable ways. We need to love one another and care for our children and care for our elderly and heal the planet. And all of those things, which are not what I would call traditional paying jobs, are profoundly important work that needs to be done. And yet we're not releasing our energy because nobody's writing us a check. That's like the teenager that says, I'm not taking out the garbage unless you pay me an allowance.
Yeah,
but when you grow up, nobody pays you an allowance. You clean your house for the sheer
Right.
So that's part of the maturation, I think, of the species. And when we get there, it will become so simple. When you think about now how much human consciousness is completely permeated with the stress of having to pay bills, where am I going to get my money, how am I going to make sure that I have enough for the future, how am I going to pay off the debt from the past, how am I going to make sure my kids are taken care of, all of those questions occupy this enormous amount of the collective consciousness. If we just drop that and said, you know what, let's just do it, let's just take care of everybody, think of all the human capacity and imagination and ability and potential that will be freed up to now direct itself to address the actual challenges that the world has given us, not the ones we've created for ourselves.
Yeah, I mean, because we wouldn't have to be a hamster on the wheel anymore. You know, we could pursue higher pursuits and actually develop ourselves, you know, as human beings.
Absolutely. And you know, the great joy that I see right now is that for really quite a few hundred years, we have been rendering ourselves obsolete in the workplace, unconsciously or subconsciously, but it's been happening. And 200 years ago, we started taking care of blue-collar labor by building machines running on fossil fuels that could replace hard physical human work in the workplace. And, you know, we moved a lot of people out of work, and that became sort of a disruptive problem for our society. Now, with technology, we're replacing white-collar brain power in the workforce, where computers running complex programs are able to do some of this tedious, mental work that humans had to do. So now, within 15 or 20 years, half of the white-collar jobs are going to go away. So once we've moved, you know, 75% of the people out of the workforce, this old formula that we have been clinging to that says, I have to go work in order to get money to buy the fruits of the labor of other people, doesn't work because it's not the fruits of the labor of other people anymore. It's the fruits of machines and technology.
Right.
So
right.
How are human beings going to play in that equation? The equation will fall. It has to
right.
fall.
Right. What advice, besides what you've already said, do you offer listeners right now? You know, what can people do in their everyday lives to, I don't know, maybe embrace this idea or, you know, help shift the paradigm in that direction?
I think one of the most fundamental choices people can make is to begin to rehabilitate the feminine in themselves by recognizing and honoring their own infinite capacity for love and compassion and generosity and kindness and nurturing and caring, and begin to give those things, which are free. You don't run out of them. You can give those in abundance to everyone you meet. And as we start practicing gifting of the infinite side of ourselves into the world, we change the world for the better, and we encourage other people to do the same. And as that energy spreads and people begin to feel safer and appreciated and nurtured and loved, they then feel comfortable giving of themselves. And also, you know, it's also important to give of our things, give of the things we have in excess. If, you know, if you're, like, I make a lot of jams. I love to make jams. So if I make 20 jars of jams, I give 18 away because I'm not going to eat 20 jars of jam. But I love the excitement that people demonstrate when I hand them a jar of homemade jam and say, here, this is for you. So I just give it. I don't expect them to pay me for it. And there's a joy in doing that. So practicing this unconditional gifting without expecting anything in return, but don't be surprised if it comes back in spades because people love to give.
Right.
We're all hungry to give our gifts. We really are. The problem is nobody's paying us for them right now, so we're not giving. But as we begin to say, fine, I don't care if I get paid or not. I'll pay myself. I'll validate myself. I will honor myself. And the payment I receive is love for myself for being this amazing being. And we move through the world that way. And as more of us do that, the gifting economy will flourish.
It's almost as if we should all become philanthropists, but not monetary philanthropists. You know?
Right. Well, the money is going to dissolve. A debt-based economy, the debt-based system is a house of cards. So this current monetary system will collapse. I have absolutely no doubt that it will collapse because of the structure of it and the way that we bring money into the world. We birth it in as debt. We attach interest to it, and we only ever birth principal, which means for every dollar that we birth into existence in order to expand the economy, we create more debt. We have to because it has to be paid back with interest, but the interest isn't created. So if you look at all the money that's ever been birthed and all the interest that's attached to all of those loans, it's the interest that's the debt. The money itself isn't the debt. It's the interest that's the debt. And so this whole process is going to escalate to a point that it becomes absurd because we're borrowing it from ourselves.
I think the scary part of it is, if we can eventually get to that place we're describing, it would be utopia, nirvana, whatever you want to call it, you know, and I don't know, maybe that sounds too far-fetched, but it's the getting there, you know, because I think about, that's the scary part, you know, because if the economy does collapse, you know, I think it would end up being more sort of post-apocalyptic, like you see on TV, you know, with the, not that there's going to be zombies in the street, but look how humans treat each other, you know, in times of stress. It's competition. It's not let's take care of one another. And that's what worries me, you know, that if things collapse and money has no value and, you know, it's going to be sort of the biggest bully with the most, you know, with the most muscles or clubs or guns and bullets are going to be the ones that it'll be like the Wild West, You know, that kind of worries me.
Well, that is one option, and it would not surprise me if some people take that approach. And one of the reasons that I encourage people to begin gifting and really anchor in compassion and ground themselves in the field of unconditional love is because the more that we set that field and create a resonant field that a lot of people are privy to and part of, that place becomes doable and achievable in a time of stress. We can stay there, and we can invite other people to come play. If, in fact, we haven't built that field, if we're not resonant in love and compassion and understanding that we're all one unified field, when challenges happen, we revert to, you know, the world's out to get me, I have to save myself, and I become a separate individual. So there is a shift in consciousness that really is fundamental to this transition, and if it doesn't occur in enough people, then exactly what you're saying will happen, which is why I believe we haven't had the collapse yet. I don't think the collapse will come until we're ready to hold a different field. And we're
have a better default position than the Wild West.
Exactly. Which is why we continue to salvage this.
Okay. Well, Eileen, let's mention your website again. It's eileenworkman.com, and the book is Sacred Economics. I think it has a subtitle, doesn't it?
The Currency of Life.
The Currency of Life. Well, Eileen, thank you so much. It's been heartening to speak to you. You really have made me feel better, and thank you so much for your insights and for showing that it is possible for people who are in positions like the 1%, because it sounds like you were up there, it's hopeful to know that they can come around.
Yeah, I figured if I could change, anybody can change. So,
well, I say that about myself with some things too. I think we all have, we all have something that is a big challenge, and when we manage to do it, we realize that others can too, and then we become the teacher. So, thank you so much, Eileen, for being on the show. I appreciate it. I'm sure my guests do too. My audience does too. Thank you.
Thank you so much for having me. I really enjoyed being here.
Thank you. Good night.
Tonight.
Well, listeners, I think I have a few things to share with you that are certainly in sync with some of the conversations I've been having tonight. The first comes from a listener who sent this to me over Facebook, and I wanted to share it. It goes like this. It's a quote from John Firelame Deer, Native American. He says, "Before our white brothers arrived to make us civilized men, we didn't have any kind of prison. Because of this, we had no delinquents. Without a prison, there can be no delinquents. We had no locks nor keys, and therefore among us there were no thieves. When someone was so poor that he couldn't afford a horse, a tent, or a blanket, he would, in that case, receive it all as a gift. We were too uncivilized to give great importance to private property. We didn't know any kind of money, and consequently the value of a human being was not determined by his wealth. We had no written laws laid down, no lawyers, no politicians. Therefore, we were not able to cheat and swindle one another. We were really in bad shape before the white man arrived, and I don't know how to explain how we were able to manage without these fundamental things that, so they tell us, are so necessary for a civilized society." So, wanted to also share with you something that came from a longtime listener, Pat, 16 things every woman's significant other should know. And this was on the Huffington Post by Alana Vagianos, and it was out there because of Valentine's Day being last week. I didn't get a chance to share it with you. So according to HuffPost Women Readers, there are 16 things every woman's significant other should know. Number one, how to make her laugh and also understand when it's not the time for laughter. Two, understand that sex is important to her, and it should come with a little enticement and a lot of respect. Three, no matter what, hugging always helps. Four, realize when it's time to talk and when it's time to listen. Five, know how she takes her coffee. 6. Vulnerability is a good thing, and without it, relationships can't grow. 7. Support and encourage her dreams, and she will love you even more. 8. Respect her as an equal who can take on the world alone, but instead chooses to do so with you. 9. Never dismiss her feelings, even if you don't fully understand or agree with them. 10. Know when it's her birthday, and don't forget it. 11. Selfless acts are what makes relationship last. 12. I'm fine doesn't always mean she's okay, and many times means the opposite. 13. Kindness is not weakness, but rather a strength. 14. Respect and encourage her career aspirations and personal ambitions. 15. Recognize that every woman is different. What was important to an ex does not always remain true for a current significant other. And number 16, the classic, understand how the female body works, and most importantly, where her clitoris is. Thank you, Pat. Well, bees buzzing round in my bonnet. Yes, indeed. That's the sound. Well, first of all, have you heard about Republicans getting involved in Tennessee between workers and the Volkswagen auto plant? Yes, Volkswagen was not opposed to their plant being unionized. After all, Germany is one of the places on Earth where workers have the strongest worker rights and a place at the table at negotiations, unlike here in the United States, where the GOP has been devastating worker rights for decades. Well, less than 100 votes made the difference at this plant after the Republican politicians lying to workers and spending tons of money trying to convince low-information voters in the South that having unions was like socialism. The employees caved into fear and bigotry and voted against their economic interests. So when are workers going to realize Republicans stand with the people who write the checks and not the people who sign the back of the check? Well, Tennessee workers, you asked for it. Now let's see how things go for you. When you're making $2 to $3 or more dollars less an hour than other auto workers and your benefits and your conditions start to suck, you made this bed and now you're going to have to lay in it. I am so tired of workers not standing up for themselves because they don't only screw themselves over. These kinds of decisions have far-reaching effects. They bleed over into the community and to what other employers pay their employees, including adding to the vast income disparity among workers in this country. Now, today I read something that seemed to imply that Volkswagen has stepped in, and it seems like they, the company, believe us or not, the company has seems like they're telling employees that they are demanding that they be unionized, and they aren't happy with these Republican politicians who got their fingers in the relationship between the workers and the company, because that's not what they're supposed to do. I mean, that's not their job. So it'll be interesting how this all plays out, but Volkswagen, the German company, has to step in the South to help the workers when they couldn't even help themselves. Also, it was the commemoration of the Beatles' debut on Ed Sullivan about a week ago, and I ran across a timely article that I wanted to share some excerpts. It's called 50 Years After the Beatles, Is It Time for Another Political and Cultural Revolution? And it says that while there's much to celebrate about the Beatles coming to America, there's also much to regret, starting with the fact that while we may remember the music of the Beatles, we've lost sight of the hope for change and revolution and the revolutionary spirit that were hallmarks of those days. 50 years later, while we may be inundated with a glut of music that passes for art and artists that passed for activists, with no shortage of national problems plaguing us, we're sorely lacking individuals with the kind of radicalism and willingness to change the status quo. This is the difference between then and now, between an America that was ripe for the Beatles' music and their message of change, and an America that is celebrating the Beatles' music while oblivious to their radicalism. Some have even argued that the Beatles' influence helped bring down the Iron Curtain, as Yuri Pelyosharenok, I can't pronounce his name, he's a Soviet studies professor, says, and I quote, "The Soviet authorities thought the Beatles had a secret Cold War weapon. The kids lost their interest in all Soviet unshakable dogmas and ideals and stopped thinking of an English-speaking person as the enemy. That's when the communists lost two generations of young people ideologically, totally lost. That was an incredible impact." Then, following the assassination of Martin Luther King and Bobby Kennedy in 68, the optimism of the summer of love quickly evaporated, and young people revolted worldwide in the United States. The cataclysm came as 10,000 demonstrators descended on the Democratic Party's National Convention in August of 68. People reacted by brutally beating rock-throwing demonstrators, as well as passersby, journalists, and volunteers. Violence and revolt were now in vogue. The Beatles' most influential pop voice of the time responded to this shift toward violence with the song Revolution, the Beatles' first song with an explicitly political statement. As Revolution stresses, the song, it was not a movement about physically overthrowing a regime, it was a spiritual revolution, one aimed at overthrowing preconceived notions. Thus, before you can effect a lasting change, as John Lennon sings, you have to free your mind. As John Lennon sings in his masterpiece on the need for nonviolent change, quote, "When you talk about destruction, don't you know that you can count me out?" So while the Beatles' greatest legacy wasn't affecting a revolution of spirit and mind, today we're in dire need of revolutionaries willing to challenge the status quo. The world could use another revolution, don't you think? I want to thank the writer of this article, John Whitehead, from opednews.com. Because I don't know about you, but it seems like to me there's just no one to replace the Beatles or the Bob Dylans of the world, you know, with these revolutionary songs to motivate and inspire and help us change our thinking, which has really been the theme of tonight, changing our consciousness. And with that thought in mind, I want to quote Karen Berg from the Kabbalah Center. She sent around a daily message, and this one's called Talking About an Evolution. She says, "You already know that we humans were put on this earth to grow spiritually, but to what end? We could isolate ourselves and become renowned religious scholars, citing spiritual verse up and down the block, but this isn't really what spiritual growth is about. To create an internal spiritual revolution, we need to learn to feel, to push outside of ourselves, to extend our love and care toward one another. Our actions don't have to be huge or grandiose. They can be as simple as making a stranger feel better or a friend become more motivated to get involved in his or her life. Ultimately, the point is to open our heart and to feel the pain of others. All of us notice and see the things happening around us. The pain and destruction is overwhelming. The world is hurting and we have to act. Our choice is to meditate for people from high in an ivory tower or to truly feel their pain inside themselves and to make a difference on the ground." Yep, that is exactly what we have been talking about all night. Well, in closing, listeners, this is my last show for the month of February. I'll be taking off next week, and we'll be back the first Wednesday in March. Please check out the archives. Some recent shows include Barbara Threecrow on how to shatter the patriarchal dominator rule in Medicine Women Earth Ways, Miriam Robbins Dexter, Sacred Display Objects, David Hillman, Beyond 50 Shades of Grey, Sex, Drugs, and Religion in the Ancient World, Sylvia Federici, Women, Witch Burning, and the Development of Capitalism. That one was really good. Tim Ward, One Woman Search for Goddess, Kathy Pagano, The Cosmic Story. So remember, dear listeners, we are the cognitive minority. We are ahead of the curve in our thinking, and we're working toward everyone else catching up. Stay motivated, stay activated, find your sacred roar. And good night, and until the first week in March. Let the Way Be Open by Abigail Spinner McBride.
Sing through my voice, play through my hands, let the way be open.